what surprises me now, and I was just talking to somebody yesterday about this, is that you look at some of the makers of YouTube makers, and once you get to a certain level of YouTube success, machine companies just start sending you crazy amounts of, you know, you want a shot bot, you want a CNC cutter, you want a laser cutter, you know, whatever. You start getting all of these machines, and now you see these videos where a person has a shop where they can fabricate pretty much anything. You know, they can cut metal, they can cut wood, they can 3D print stuff. And so I don't know about like what the new, I mean, everyone always says like the Internet of Things is going to be the next, one of the next big areas for, you know, both commercial development and DIY development. But to me, it's just getting that level of desktop fabrication technology in the hands of more and more people. So, you know, sort of if you can think it, you can make it.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, maker, writer, and former editorial director of Maker Media, Gareth Branwyn joins John and Scoop for a wide-ranging discussion about makers and making. We examine small town life, the maker movement, makers on YouTube, and Gareth's new book, Tales and Tips from the Workshop, Volume 2.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. And our guest today is my good friend, Gareth Branwyn, who's a freelance writer, former editorial director of Maker Media. He's also the author or editor of over a dozen books on tech, DIY, geek culture, and he's just published the second volume of Make, Tips and Tales from the Workshop, a handy reference for makers. This book collects wisdom and tips about measuring and cutting, gluing, fastening, clamping, joining, drilling, shop organizing, maintenance and repair, all kinds of stuff. So, Gareth, how are you?
I'm really good. Good to be with you guys today. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know, how long? A couple of years, a year?
I was wondering about that. Yeah, we did that Beyond Cyberpunk podcast. Like, I think that might have been 2 years ago.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, welcome back. And I hear that you recently moved from Virginia to California. That's a pretty big move. What's that like?
Yeah, big move in every sense of the word. Yeah, I got married in September.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
And, yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, my wife is a fine artist. And she lived in Bethesda, Maryland. I lived in Arlington, Virginia. And so we sold our two places and moved out here. Actually, I sold my place. She's renting hers. But we moved out here in the fall. And we moved to Benicia, California, which is northeastern part of the Bay Area. Uh-huh. Really beautiful. It's such a beautiful, it's a little town. It's like Mayberry RFD. So it's kind of a sweet little historical town.
Did you suffer any kind of culture shock?
Well, we joke about the fact that there's Benicia time here. Like you go to a shop which is supposed to be open, and the proprietor's in the shop, and they just say, "Yeah, no, we're not really open today." They're like, "Oh, can you come back tomorrow?" Sure.
How big is Benicia? Is it a small town?
It's very small. Yeah, I'd have no idea what the population is, but it's very historical. It was the capital of California for a very short period of time. It has a big arsenal here. It was the largest repository of weapons, military hardware on the West Coast.
I believe they had nuclear weapons stored out there and in Concord, which is a nearby.
Yeah, Concord is very nearby. But yeah, the arsenal now, the base, is now a lot of art spaces. Benicia is very art focused, so it's really perfect for my wife. And there's maker stuff going on here. There's a lot of really interesting stuff. But the arsenal is now, which was built, I think, before the American Civil War. It's an amazing building with these huge, 10-foot tall ceilings and big windows, and 12 foot tall, maybe. They're enormous, but really beautiful buildings. And yeah, it's a really, really cool town. We just hit like the perfect place to land and sort of semi-retirement.
How did you find it?
Time in our lives. Well, we moved out here because our two sons are here, and my wife's son, Keith, just gave us a list of towns to check out. And so we came out here last summer and drove around, and we just liked Benicia immediately. A lot of it because we could sort of smell the art culture of the places. Tons of galleries on First Street, which is the main drag. But
so are your sons living closer to like San Francisco?
Keith lives in Oakland, and my son Blake lives in San Rafael. So they're like 35 minutes away, so really close. Yep.
And you got a lot of parks around there, it looks like.
We've got a lot of everything. The sunsets on the back deck of our house are just astonishing. My wife and I sit out there every night with a half a glass of Guinness.
It looks like there's a Six Flags there. Six Flags Discovery Kingdom. Do you know anything about that? Have you been there?
No. That's we haven't really done a lot of exploring yet.
It looks like there's a lot to explore. And you're not too far from San Francisco. What is it, about a 45-minute drive or so?
Yeah, maybe even quicker if it's not trafficy. 35 minutes, 40 minutes. Yeah, it's pretty quick. And we haven't, you know, I have a lot of connections through Make Magazine and the Maker Movement and Boing Boing and all kinds of stuff in this area. But, of course, because of COVID, we haven't really circulated much yet. So
yeah, there are a lot of maker groups in the area. Back when I lived in Oakland and San Leandro, there were all sorts of people even then, as the maker movement was beginning to get going.
Oh, yeah, no, there are tons. Yeah, there's a maker space. I haven't checked it out yet, but there's a maker space here in Benicia, so I'll definitely be getting involved in that.
So tell me, what's happened with Make Magazine? Is it no longer in existence? Or
no, it's still around. You know, they went bankrupt, and then they came back in a sort of a new, slightly newer form. Calling themselves Make Community. They have the magazine, and they just started putting the magazine out in the original format, the digest size format, which I always really loved. So I'm thrilled about that. But yeah, they're still around. They're not doing the fairs anymore.
Those were probably very difficult to do.
A lot of work. I mean, I was involved in that, and it's just a staggering. I mean, I wasn't involved in the staggering part, but there, yeah, staggering amount of work to do those. But the cool thing is now the maker movement has penetrated culture so much to the point where those fairs are still going on. They're just not through Make anymore, but there's still fairs, maker.
Yeah,
fairs
just local.
Yeah,
they do one here in Austin, I think. I think they're still doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm not sure whether it's annual, but
yeah, they do a big one. They still do a big one in I think Rome and Paris. You know, there's big cities in Europe, I think Tokyo and Shenzhen, China. There's still a lot of them going on.
You mentioned the difficulty of putting on maker fairs. It's very similar to what John and I and other people with Plutopia had to deal with trying to do events at South by Southwest. At some point it just became stupid because you were spending $10,000 to make $5,000. So it's like, well, that doesn't work too well.
Yeah, no, and it's just, yeah, the number of moving parts. I always had tremendous respect for the producers who were putting the fair together because it's just, the amount of work is just unfathomable.
Yeah, and in fact,
just the moving parts, you know, everything is in motion. And just a little bit where, like, I was doing a big panel one year, and I found out the morning before the panel that one of my panelists, which I think everyone was coming to see, was not going to make it. So you got a lot of that. So that's just a microcosm, you know, just one person dealing with this, all of this stuff going on in motion and trying to quickly, fix that, find somebody else.
Yeah, Plutopia Productions, which was, you know, sort of the original incarnation of Plutopia, actually emerged from an event at the first Austin Maker Fair. We had an installation there called the DIY Home of the Future, and it was really a test run for our idea of doing kind of what we were thinking was that you could have a think tank that made events instead of white papers, you know. So that was our first big production number.
I remember the DIY Home of the Future.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to do. And the name Plutopia came from an after meeting after we did that, a kind of debrief that we were doing, and somebody came up with that name for pluralist utopias. It's actually a portmanteau. But wow, that Maker Faire was amazing. I was surprised how much stuff they brought. You know, they brought a ton of stuff out here for it. And then, people showed up from all over the place.
Yeah, no, that was both of the Austin fairs were amazing.
Well, you've been in touch with you've been in touch with the Maker movement for a long time, and I'm sure you've seen it change over the years. What's the current direction? Is there a new direction, new kinds of making that's going on that kind of surprised you?
What surprises me now, and I was just talking to somebody yesterday about this, is that you look at some of the makers of YouTube makers, and once you get to a certain level of YouTube success, machine companies just start sending you crazy amounts of, you know, you want a ShopBot, you want a CNC cutter, you want a laser cutter, you know, whatever. You start getting all of these machines, and now you see these videos where a person has a shop where they can fabricate pretty much anything. You know, they can cut metal, they can cut wood, they can 3D print stuff. And so I don't know about like what the new, I mean, everyone always says like the Internet of Things is going to be the next, one of the next big areas for, you know, both commercial development and DIY development. But to me, it's just getting that level of desktop fabrication technology in the hands of more and more people. So, you know, sort of if you can think it, you can make it. But in terms of the maker movement in general, I think that, you know, with Make going bankrupt and being a little less influential in this movement, people always ask me, is it dead? Is it going to die? Is it a fad? Those sorts of things. And I think it's just what happens to any of these cultural movements, like the arts and crafts movement or the DIY movement after the after World War II, the whole sort of popular mechanics movement, all of that, that they just get absorbed into popular culture, that they don't go away. They don't die. They just become more and more. I mean, now you can see commercials where Home Depot uses the term maker. NBC with the Making It show, you know, they maker, everything is they use that word maker over and over again. So I think that it just becomes part of popular culture. So I think the maker movement has reached that level in which it's just more and more people are getting access to these DIY technologies.
Yeah, it sounds like the maker movement has moved from the maker fairs to online.
I mean, to me, a lot of it, and maybe I'm just prejudiced because I spend so much of my day on YouTube looking at maker videos and science and technology videos. But to me, it seems like so much of it is on YouTube, you know, project-based channels on YouTube, and they just keep on growing and growing. And now they're being fed by things like I mentioned the Making It show on NBC, which was a big success, the reality, project show, contest show. And then they just had Jimmy DiResta and a bunch of other makers had a show on Netflix called Making Fun, which was popular and pretty funny. And it gets the whole maker idea into the zeitgeist. And each time that happens, I think it just penetrates deeper and deeper into popular culture.
As I've seen things happen on YouTube, I agree that a lot of people are just there sharing things that they feel other people will like. And then there are others who are just trying to become a star or trying to get a startup going. You know, there's all sorts of reasons to be making things on YouTube. But
yeah,
personally, I found it really valuable because I've had project here at my home. I didn't know how to do something. I really needed to fix this. I would go search on YouTube and you would find 15 people showing you how to do it.
Oh yeah. No, that the resource of that is just amazing to me. I a couple of years ago, I got a really decent airbrush. I've been wanting to learn airbrushing for a long time. And I got a really decent airbrush, and it was that thing where, because it was good enough, it was an Iwata, I think it's the Iwata Revolution brush. But because it was expensive enough, I was very nervous about using it, because I know that if you bend the needle, you can mess it up. There's a number of things you can do to screw up an expensive airbrush. So I was always very scared about it. So I got clogged and I was trying to take it apart, and I thought I had bent the needle. So I've just absolutely, you know, it's one of these things, you're sweating, you're like, you know, you're getting more and more frustrated. And I just thought, wait a minute, let me go on to YouTube. I bet you there's a video on how to properly clean and put an Iwata airbrush back together. So I searched on the model. Of course, there were, you know, 5 different videos. I watched one of them. I went through all the steps. I put my brush back together and I went on my way. I just thought, that's really amazing. There's probably nothing or very few things that you could think about in a situation like that that you would search on and you wouldn't find the resources that you need and specific troubleshooting things for whatever your problem is. And so, yeah, I think it's just an invaluable resource.
So you, talking about your latest book, which is volume 2 of the tips, Tips and Tales from the Workshop. How did you get into collecting these tips in the first place?
You know, I was just thinking about that recently, that I've almost always worked in short form content, going all the way back, you know, to the Jargon Watch column in Wired. I used to write reviews for Street Cred in Wired. Going even back earlier than that, I worked for the Futurist magazine for years doing computer, you know, computer related reviews, short reviews. My first gig was at Communities magazine, a magazine about cooperative living, that I did the resources section in the back. So I've all, and I think it all comes from the Whole Earth Catalog, being influenced by the Whole Earth Catalog and how much I loved how much information you get from a single Whole Earth Catalog entry. You had the smart comments about the book, you had excerpts from the book, you had an image of the book, and you really could get a good flavor for what that document was, why it was important, with a very small amount of information. And so I think that really inspired me to go that route of just, I tend to work most exclusively in short form content. So after I left Make, I had been doing a column in Make of tips. I thought, why don't I just start a newsletter where I'll just start collecting these. And then once I've got enough of them together, I'll throw them into a book. And, you know, just that'll be one of my little gigs to keep. I wanted to make sure that I kept my foot in the maker movement, since I've gone so deep into that domain. So that's what I did. The first book, volume 1, which came out in 2018, was a collection of my column from Make, largely. And then the latest one is from my newsletter. And now my newsletter is part of the Cool Tools Network, Kevin Kelly and Mark Fraunfelder's site. So they now co-own the content. So probably going forward, I'll work with them to do produce other tips books.
Is that what they're primarily involved in now, is their Cool Tools project?
Well, you know, both Kevin and Mark, they do, yeah, 10 million things at the same time. But yeah, that's one of their big things. Mark has been doing that for years now, and they do just such a great job. The site's great, the Cool Tools podcast, the other, Claudia Dawson, who works there, has a publication called What's in My Bag, or I think it's what No, that's the amoeba one. But it's, yeah, it's a bags, you know, like bag everyday carries. Well, like what do you carry around with you and stuff? That's a cool newsletter. They have the Recommendo newsletter where they just recommend, each person recommends one really great thing for the week. So I'm now part of that organization. I have if you go to Gares tips and tools.com, that's my newsletter, which comes out every week.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize that was there. I'll have to look that up. I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned Whole Earth, like Whole Earth Catalog, Coevolution Quarterly, those publications that Whole Earth was making. And of course, Kevin was the editor of Coevolution Quarterly and Whole Earth Review for years, but I wrote a bunch of those reviews myself. And I know that when I started blogging, I thought that that was kind of what the project was. Mm-hmm. Like blogging to me, what made sense to do was to write a blog post, kind of like you'd write one of those reviews.
Yeah.
So I think that format was really influential. And it's interesting to hear that you've derived so much from it. It's a great way to present information.
Yeah, no, it really changed my life. The Whole Earth Catalog, just the editorial, the Whole Earth Reviews editorial edict or whatever was, write like you're writing to an intelligent but uninformed friend. That was one of theirs. And the other one was, write a review. Now write a letter to a friend of yours telling you why the review, you know, explaining the review or why this book is great, and then throw the review away and, you know, and send us the letter. So just that idea of there's like conversational style, focusing on the you know, the passion of like only writing about things that you like. That's, you know, Boing Boing still, you know, did that for years too. We
Absolutely,
only covered,
yeah.
We didn't do critical reviews. We did reviews of things that we thought were amazing and wonderful. And, you know, the original idea of the Boing Boing website, a catalog of wonderful things, or directory of wonderful things.
Now, mostly it says mostly wonderful things, doesn't it?
And then it should be changed again, because when you look, it's like now with Ukraine and January, you know, most of the posts are political. It's like, I don't know that any of this is wonderful.
A directory of grim and explosive things. So I want to ask you about something that you said in an interview, because I said Plutopia is a portmanteau of pluralist utopias, and you referred in an interview to the utopian dimensions of tips. Can you explain what you meant by that? I thought that was a cool quote.
Yeah, and this gets in, speaking of Whole Earth and Kevin Kelly, just the Whole Earth mentality, which still is so very much a part of the way that I look at the world. You know, Kevin has this idea that a tool is not just something that you can do something with. It's a sort of a window onto possibilities. It shows you what you could do. It gives you another set of sort of mental tools when thinking about, and that goes back to the thing I was saying about now people have, you know, you have an idea and you have these very sophisticated tools in your garage, many of us, where you can render those ideas. So just seeing, like, when you learn about 3D printing and you find out, oh, I could print replacement parts for my house. That's just a whole new way of thinking that the tool, even if you never do it, you know it's there, it's a potential. So that aspect of tools and tips really fascinates me. And then the aspirational, which is related to that, the aspirational qualities of them. You read a tip and you think, oh, wow, I could do that this way. You know, it sort of changes the way you think about a work activity or a method of making or whatever. And so that to me is the sort of utopian dimensions of them, is the idea that they offer, they sort of tickle your brain in an interesting way. And they offer windows into the possible things that you can do. And obviously the real idea is that you use these things and they change your work life. They change the way that you do things. And there's so many tips that I've put in these two books, which now just they've become part of my daily life. You know, they've really changed the way that I do physical things in the world.
Well, I've always thought of makers as a bunch of progressive, free thinker, you know, people like you. And I was frightened when I discovered there are other makers out there on the alt-right. I was doing some research, kind of cruising around to see what these people were saying. And there's a lot of makers with interests like how to make a really good Molotov cocktail, how to make a, you know, untraceable gun, how to make a bomb. I mean, like, what do you think of that kind of maker?
Well, there, you know, there's always been that, you know, if you guys probably remember the Loom Panics catalog, but that was basically an early kind of a DIY catalog of, you know, how to erase your identity, how to get stolen weapon, you know, how to make bombs. And the Anarchist Cookbook, I mean, that's all been there for a long time. It's really interesting. I did a book in 1997 called Jamming the Media, A Citizen's Guide to Reclaiming the Tools of Communication. And, you know, I'm a progressive. And so I wrote it from that point of view and I published the book. And then I start getting letters and then reviews on Amazon from right-wing, like zine publishers, basically, who were really inspired by my book and got ideas of how to, you know, create zines or promote zines or do things online. And I thought, well, this at the time, I thought this is actually kind of cool because I didn't write this book for you, but I wrote it. It's a citizen's guide for reclaiming the tools of communication. So if you want to reclaim those tools, you have every right to do that. But, you know, then you, yeah, like one of the guys did a zine where it was like, you know, black helicopters and, you know, government implants and all of that kind of stuff. So it really was sort of the beginnings of that kind of QAnon underground. A lot of that has been driven by, if you consider things like YouTube DIY technology, which it is, a lot of this stuff has been driven by these democratizing tools that we sort of naively, or at least for myself, I sort of naively just thought, oh, people like me are going to use this stuff, not people who want to destroy me and to democratic society.
Yeah, that's what I thought when I first encountered that kind of maker. I was doing the news for Pacifica Radio in Houston. This was back in the early 1970s. And I started getting all of these tips from people with various underground papers and publications, things like a do-it-yourself black box so you didn't have to pay for your phone calls. Then, you wanted to call someone in New York, you had to have the money to do it. It wasn't any free smartphone call. You had to pay, you know, AT&T for the right to talk to mom in New York City. And people came up with all these great devices and methods to get around that. Even a simple one like going to a payphone, you could go and take the cover off the mouthpiece, get a beer pull tab, and short it out against body of the phone, and you'd get a dial tone without having to put in the money. And that stuff like that was going around. It's like, and it went on to stuff like the stuff you've encountered. I just thought It was interesting that it's been around. I mean, makers have been around for a long time. We didn't invent them.
I mean, yeah, people think, you know, they get all haughty about, you know, it's like, well, you know, just like you said, but like, well, why is it maker? You know, maker's been around for a long time. You act like it's a new thing. It's like, no, it's just an identity. It's just taking, you know, the brilliance of what Dale Doherty did at Make was to take all of these different areas of DIY, you know, from crafting and hobby electronics and robotics and traditional shop craft and all that stuff. And cooks, you know, Dale likes to say, everybody is a maker. You know, everybody, if you cook or, you know, work on your car or, you know, that's all maker activity. It's just basically celebrating a part of our lives that we all do, and then sharing how we do it and creating sort of an identity and a community around it that makes it easier to do it. And you feel empowered to try things that you normally wouldn't. One of the things that I absolutely love about the maker movement is the early emphasis on the right to fail. And you know, Mark Fraunfelder had, I think, permission to play. And to me, that's one of the greatest things, because there's, when you're learning a new skill, there's often this stigma around, oh, am I going to look stupid or, you know, whatever. There's an intimidation factor in learning something new. So having that sense of it doesn't really matter. I'm just playing. I'm exploring. I take, you know, the early motto of MAKE was technology on your time. So that idea that you can learn it at whatever pace you want to learn it, those things I think have all been sort of the more powerful things that are driving the maker movement. That I hope are the kinds of things that are penetrating into mainstream culture. That those ideas that it's all right to try new things, to fail, to go online. What you were talking about with, you know, getting resources online. You can start something and then just go online and go in and find a group and say, I'm trying to do X and I can't figure out how to do Y. And you'll get a response frequently, like immediately, or at least within 24 hours. So there's
an eager response. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly. Like, people are eager to help you. That's just such a wonderful aspect of all of this. And, you know, we spend a lot of time now dogging the internet and how awful it, you know, a lot of what it's enabled, but at the same time, you know, these are examples of how it really has empowered people in very exciting ways.
Yeah. And, you know, people who have achieved a lot have also failed a hell of a lot. You know, that's sort of like anybody who accomplishes anything has learned to live with failure along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I actually think one of the criticisms that I have for a lot of YouTube videos is that the project videos, that the person will edit it and they won't leave in their mistakes. Or they've started into a project and then have had like a major failure or something that they can't figure out. They just stop and then fix it and then go on. Like, you know, they don't let you in on that process. So I love it when it's a video where somebody starts in on a project and then just, oh my God, I'm way into the weeds. I bit off way more than I could chew. And then the whole process of how they have to recover from that, and then, you know, what they end up with might not be nearly what they went in expecting, because that's what we all do. Like, I've never done anything where I haven't, you know, had some point in the process where I've had to problem solve or something that I really wanted to happen didn't happen. It's just part of the nature of the beast.
Well, how about the problem of putting the books together? You did one volume, you've done a second volume now. How hard is that to organize? I mean, is this stuff that you had already written for the newsletters and you're just organizing it, or do you write a lot of new content? How does that process go?
For the newsletters now, I write a lot of, for the books, there it's almost all existing content. I fleshed out a couple of areas. The new book, I have new chapters in there that I did not have in the first volume. I have one on hobby tips, because I've been doing a lot of tabletop game crafting for role-playing games and skirmish war games and stuff like that. So I had a column in a gaming magazine for a while. And so I had done a lot of stuff for that. And so I pulled some of that stuff and did a lot of original stuff for that. But most of it is just now I have this whole process where I do the newsletter and then I can derive things from that. You know, I can sort of double dip and I can do stuff for the newsletter and then put those into future books. I mean, that's been sort of the way that I've set myself up. This book is maybe 75% content from the first year and a half of my newsletter.
Or when you say this book, you mean
volume
the second
two. Yeah, volume two. Yeah.
And volume one was
mainly from the column that I did at Make for, I think, 2 years for the website, a weekly tips column.
So what kind of response are you getting to both volumes, really?
It's been phenomenal. I don't know that I've ever done any project, that and my newsletter, which it's all sort of the same thing. It's all just doing these short form tips pieces, but I've just gotten an incredibly positive response. The greatest compliment that I've gotten is frequently people will say, people say, I'm not a maker, which is ridiculous, but they come up to me at events and things, say, I'm not a maker, but I love reading your newsletter. I love seeing what other people are doing. I love, again, this idea of seeing possibilities. Like if I wanted to go down this rabbit hole and do electronics, you know, that's a cool tip that I'll try to remember. So it's by and large, it's been very positive. I did get a couple of, you know, there's a thing that makers get into, like a lot of the project makers on YouTube, where a lot of experts in whatever the domain is, woodworking, welding, whatever anybody is doing, there'll be lots of negative comments. No, you can't do it that way, you know, so there's a lot of sort of expert abuse. So I've gotten a couple of those letters, angry letters saying, you know, it is entirely unsafe to do XYZ. And there probably, is truth to that. Or it's not OSHA. It's not, you know, OSHA certified.
Well, that raises the question. Do you test the tips before you put them in the book?
Mostly not. I test, you know, easy tips to test. I test those. And then I try to do due diligence where I will, if I see something someplace, I will look other places and then I'll look in the comments and see what the expert feedback is, that sort of thing. And something I just started in my newsletter, which I'm really excited about, is something called Tips Busters, where I'm deputizing readers to take either one of my tips or just a tip that they see on YouTube or in their travels and actually try it out. So one of the tips from my first book that people said, oh, I bet that doesn't work, which is reviving felt markers by just taking the nib off and putting a couple of drops of isopropyl alcohol on it to revive it. Because when a marker dries out, the pigment's still there. It's the alcohol that has vaporized. So if you reintroduce the alcohol, you revive the marker. Well, I read that and I just thought, I bet that sounds like that works. So I put it in the book and then people said, oh, I bet that doesn't work. So that was the first tip that I tried out. And it was interesting because the instruction was a few drops. And I tried a few drops and it dried out within an hour. It was back to basically being unusable. So I ended up soaking the whole felt barrel, you know, the whole felt piece that's inside the marker. And now it still works. It's been a month. I'm using it all the time. And so that was the first one that I tested. But there have been things where that anger professionals, like I mentioned, there's misinformation about, you know, people think WD-40 is for lubrication, which it's really not. You know, WD-40, you know, used to free up bolts and things you spray on.
What's it for?
Well, it's for things like us freeing up frozen bolts. It's not for as a lubricant. Like people say, oh, you can use it on your door hinges. And yeah, stuff. It's not optimal for that. I've used it for that. I don't know that it's going to like ruin your door hinge.
Yeah, it's basically breaking up the oxidization that has happened on metal pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, I had a tip in the book, which is like a really old tip, which is if it moves and it shouldn't, duct tape. If it doesn't move and it should, WD-40. I just thought it was a sort of a cute thing, but there are two triggers in that. Using WD-40 as a lubricant is not recommended, and people who are real maker types, professional maker type, hate duct tape. So I stepped in it twice there, and several people have written and said, you know, that I had showed my amateurness by putting that in there. But yeah, it was sent to me by an engineer. I thought it was funny. I put it in the book.
I just want to say I went to the WD-40 site, and it says that WD-40 multi-use product is not really a lubricant, is a myth. And they say while the WD and WD-40 stands for water displacement, WD-40 multi-use product is a unique special blend of lubricants. The product's formulation also contains anti-corrosion agents and ingredients for penetration, water displacement, and soil removal. So it sounds like it's kind of a jack of all trades.
Yeah, well, they're really going with how people have applied it. That's the general consensus. And then there's been a thing again by people who are experts. And yes, I'm sure there are better penetrants and lubricants and things than you can use. But most people just reach for the WD-40 because it's convenient. I was lubricating my hinges for years with WD-40 before someone said, oh, you can't do that. It's like, well, no, actually, I can't.
Well, I used WD-40 to kill an ant bed that cropped up in my studio one time. So I don't think that was in the list.
Multi-purpose.
It was very multi and very messy.
I've seen people use it in locks. You know, when they should have been using graphite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, yes, there are the proper things you should use, and then there are things that you use that work sort of, kind of, you have handy, so you use them.
Do you put disclaimers on your tips, such as it may not do what you want it to, or you it made it, you know, destroy your workshop.
Well, I have a global disclaimer in the front of the book, two of them. One, you know, yes, that these are not necessarily tested out, fully tested. Use common sense. See what other people are saying about it. You know, do your homework. Don't do anything you don't feel confident in doing. So I have that kind of a global disclaimer. And then I have one called, hey, that's my tip. Because people have this thing that they think they own a tip. Even if you come up with it and you express it online, if I write about it and don't use your exact words, you don't own the tip. You know what I mean? I tried as much as possible in the book to give people credit of where I got it. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the person who came up with the idea. But I really tried to make both of these books feel as community-based as possible. So I have all of the people who contributed that I know who they are in the front of the book. So it really does feel like it's a community effort. But part of that is just, I see a tip in a video, I'm going to put it in there, and I'm sure that people look at these and go like, hey, he didn't ask me to put this in the book. But I think in giving them credit and this idea that I'm not actually using their words, I'm explaining the hack, the tip, the whatever in my own words.
Yeah. Have you encountered people out there, nefarious types who are like serial credit takers who are doing the Henry Ford thing? Yeah, it's mine. I invented it.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, we when I was working for Make, we had people that got so incensed if we wrote about their video. And that we had one guy who messaged us and said, never mention me on Make again, or I'm going to, you know, sue you or whatever. I just thought that is the weirdest impulse to stop people talking about your YouTube channel. I don't really understand what the thinking was there. But yeah, I think he has this like hyper sense of ownership and got really offended that we would, you know, put up a substantive post that linked to him, that he feels like we're stealing his content. So
I want to officially give you permission to mention our YouTube channel anywhere and everywhere you want to.
Really?
I mean, that's as it should be. So do you have favorite tips?
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, a couple that I'm really proud of because I came up with them myself is, in this book, I have a kitchen hacks chapter. Because my wife and I started subscribing to Cooks Illustrated again, and they have a really great tips section. So that sort of got me in the mind of cool kitchen hacks. So I eat a lot of pancakes, waffles. I love, you know, traditional breakfast food, but and I can't stand a fake syrup. So, you know, maple syrup is very expensive. And so, but if you don't put enough on, is that thing where the, you know, the pancakes kind of dry. And so I started experimenting with dipping the pancake or waffle in the maple syrup, as opposed to just pouring the syrup on, and you use at least half as much syrup. So that's a really, really great way to save syrup. So that was one of the ones that I came up with. The other one is hamburger buns, where you eat a hamburger and the whole thing starts disintegrating when you're halfway through because the meat has soaked into the bottom bun and then the condiments have soaked into the top bun. And so you just put a piece of lettuce between at the top and the bottom of everything. So the meat juice can't soak into the bun, the bottom bun, and the condiments can't soak into the top bun. And that was like a real revelation to me.
Why did I never think of that?
Yeah, one of those. Why did I never think of that before?
I think I'm going to have flapjacks and hamburgers tonight.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, those are two that, and those are, you know, I use those all the time now. So those are favorites. Yeah, anything that to me that you actually use, that instantly you read it. One of the ones from The Essential Craftsman, this guy, I think, is Scott Waddington. I think he's a Canadian guy who has a channel called The Essential Craftsman. He has a meta tip, which in the book I call the meta tips, details layer, which is the idea when you're doing something at every level that you add in making something, if you sort of skimped or it's not right on level one, it's going to compound into level two and level three. And I find that a lot in doing like working with styrene, making tabletop models and stuff. If it's not square to begin with, it's not going to get square. That lack of squareness is going to compound throughout the rest of the project. And so that concept of details layer, like you have to be mindful and organize and do the right thing on every level of your project, or at least the best you can, because over time throughout the project, those mistakes or whatever are going to compound. The opposite of that, is also, I think, a really wonderful tip, which I got from my friend Andy Berkey, who is one of his jobs is he restores Gothic cathedrals. And the tip is just make it perfect enough. And he gives an example of when you go into a Gothic church and you look up into the rafters or whatever, and, you know, it's so beautiful and the craftsmanship is so amazing. When you actually get up into the rafters, you can see that there are just a world of mistakes, but they're not visible from the distance that anybody's ever going to see it, because most people aren't going to actually be up in the rafters. So it's perfect enough. It looks perfect on the ground. It doesn't have to be perfect in the rafters. So I think that's a really great thing to keep in mind, that ultimately you got to, you know, you do the best you can throughout the process, but ultimately you got to go for perfect enough. If you're obsessed with perfection, you're never going to be happy. You know, it's going to be a frustrating process. So I love those two for that.
It sounds a bit like pointillism in art, where it's just a bunch of dots when you're up close, but you back off and you see the artwork.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's honor it at the level in which it's going to be perceived or whatever. It doesn't. But that's one of the amazing things that I like about working on a project, is you do get so down into the minutiae of what you're doing. You can see every mistake. And I've had these situations where I'm working on something, it's very frustrating, and I think, oh God, this is really not working out. This really sucks. And I'll go to bed and I'll get up the next morning and I'll come in and look at it, and I have a completely different field of view. You know, my field of view has gotten narrower and narrower as I'm working on the thing. And then you look at it the next day and you're out here. And it's like, oh no, that actually, that looks great. And so that's a similar sort of concept. Also in the book, I have, these sort of practical meta tips. Like Adam Savage is really into the idea of, you put casters on everything that you can in your shop. So in the first book, I talked about a concept that he had called first order retrieval, which is the idea that as you're working on a project, everything in your shop is potentially mobile, so that you can move the things towards you that you need immediately. And then when you're done with that project, those things get pushed back. So all of the stuff in the shop moves towards you as you need it. Well, for that, you need caster. So in this book, in the second volume, I talk about that idea of getting everything on casters if you can, putting casters on anything if you can, and then having casters around. Like he always has a stash of, and get decent casters, not the cheap, crappy kind. So I love tips like that. Like that's definitely what changes the whole nature of how you would interact with your workspace.
What do you think about kits versus making things from scratch?
I love kits. I ever since I was a kid, I had a huge attraction, model kits, model rocket kits, anything in a kit form. There's something really attractive to me about it. But I think at one point in the maker movement, when the maker movement was starting to take off, then everybody started producing kits, and that's good in one way. But then the other thing is, you're not figuring it out for yourself. Like the difference between putting together an electronics kit versus figuring out the circuit yourself, designing the circuit yourself, figuring out all the different values of the components that you need. Those are two entirely different things. So my only worry about is, if there's too much emphasis on kits, then people get a sense that they're, doing electronics hobbying, but they're not really going deep enough to understand how the things actually work. It's kind of a more rote process. But if that gets people involved, in something like I was in really into hobby robots for years. And mainly what I did, I may made a few scratch built robots, but most of them were kits. And that was, for me, in the level that I was at, that was completely fine.
Yeah, I have a moderate Lego addiction. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like, should I really be doing this? Should I really be making these you know, sort of like very precision engineered Lego kits, putting those together, or should I be doing something that's more from my head, you know?
Well, but the cool thing about Legos is that they really are a sandbox, you know, that you really can make anything that you possibly would like to, you know.
The guys who are really into it get the big, like, what is it? The big professional edition of just a bunch of blocks that you can tailor. And I was seeing something the other day where a guy had built amazing things, like amazing replicas of existing like monuments and things like that. And he had just built them from scratch, basically, just using Lego materials.
There's so many, you know, technical Legos, you know, for, you know, actuators, sensors, computer control. You can really do, you know, all kind. I love the ones who the project to make brick sorters. So you make a Lego brick sorter out of Legos that you just feed your Legos into it, and it'll put them all back, you know, by color or whatever.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember the predecessors to Legos, things like the Erector set and building blocks and Lincoln Logs that came out in like the late 40s or in the 50s. And those were great. And I saw some, I didn't do any great works of art, but I saw some great things put together with the Erector sets that no one really thought you could make. And you know, people would bring in extra screws and bolts and stuff and make amazing structures.
Yeah, no, that was my, I always think that was my real entree into making was, I was of that generation. I had the Erector set, Lincoln Logs, the vacuum form, the thingamagoop, all of these kits for, you know, these tools for making your own stuff. And then from there, I got into things like model rockets and
I had the Gilbert chemistry set, which allowed me to make my first gunpowder, which was caused a big uproar in the house when I blew up my bed.
I had the American plastic bricks.
Those I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that was quite a little kit by Elgo. You know, you have Lego now, but there was Elgo back then. Those were, as far as I know, the original plastic bricks. And you could just build like a house out of them or something like that. They mm-hmm. have, you frame a house and build just kind of a square house and put windows in it and that sort of thing, doors. Those were the days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my introduction to making stuff was the Erector set, which I got probably when I was, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8. I saw the commercials, and I got my, before Christmas, I asked for it for Christmas. I saw the commercials and, you know, they may always make it look in the commercials like you can build, you know, something way more sophisticated than what comes with the parts in the actual kit. So I saw the commercials and I thought, I'm going to get one of these, ask for one of these for Christmas, and I'm going to build me a robot that will do my chores for me. And so I told my cousin that after I got it and I opened it up, and the original Erector set, there was really not that much stuff in it. It was like some beams, and I think there was one DC motor, and there was a couple of tools, and you know, I think you can make like a little crane. But I'd way over imagined what was possible. Again, the potential that it represented got the best of me. And I told my cousin that I said, oh yeah, no, I've made a robot that can do my, I just went with the fantasy. And so he said, oh, well, that'll be great because I'm coming over next weekend. I can meet your robot. And so I tried all week long to make something that would sort of pass as a robot that would do my chores. And when the time came and he came over, I had to admit, I was lying. And then he told my parents and I got in big trouble.
You needed a golem, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. I was sort of down to that, throwing clay together. Please.
You know, I remember seeing what was it? I saw Curse of Frankenstein, the Hammer version of, of the Frankenstein movies. And I got it into my head that I could get a bug and put it in water and somehow I could revive it, you know, bring it back to life. And one part of that is like, you would probably have to apply electricity to it, but at least I was smart enough to know that I'd probably electrocute myself if I did that. So I never quite got that far, but it was really, I mean, the ideas that you get in your head when you're a kid.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
There was a band, I think their name was OK Go, something like that, that did the amazing videos of where they just put together these amazing processes, Rube Goldberg things. And that,
they were very much involved in the Maker Faires, and they would come to Maker Faires and do a bunch of those things. They did a performance where they were wearing fish bowls on their heads with actual water and fish in them. You know, they had diving masks on and they had these giant fish bowls. It was crazy.
There you.
Oh yeah. This, you're showing us the, yeah, that Rube Goldberg construction is really astonishing.
Have you ever built anything like that? A Rube Goldberg contraption?
No, the closest thing I ever got to that was playing Mousetrap as a kid. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. And there was a giant mousetrap at Maker Faire.
Yeah, yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah, no, that was really a cool thing. But I love when my son was like 15 years old. I know, maybe a little older than that, but still a teenager, and we went to a Maker Faire and it said life-size mousetrap, and he looked at it and he goes, wait, wouldn't life-size be mouse size? Which I thought was just a great observation. Like, no, it's a human-size mousetrap, it's not a life-size mousetrap.
Are those guys still around? I wonder if they actually make a living touring around with that thing.
Well, they did during Maker Faire because they had a little, you know, they had a circuit going. They were doing the major fairs. They were going to other events and stuff. So they had enough events to go to. Well, certainly after COVID, I don't know, you know, what they're doing.
Some people may wonder what we're talking about. The Mousetrap game was very Rube Goldberg. And I guess a lot of people today probably don't know who Rube Goldberg was, but it was... Contraptions is all I can think of.
A Rube Goldberg contraption is a super overcomplicated construct that does a very, very simple thing. So yeah, it's like it's a meditation on overcomplication, I guess. But yeah, and then the life-size mousetrap was the board game, Milton Bradley, I think, board game called Mousetrap, which you build a Rube Goldberg machine to trap a mouse. And so, yeah, the life-size mousetrap was just a giant one where the final was a car gets crushed at the end. A car gets a giant metal ball dropped on it.
You mentioned before people getting angry about like using their stuff and all that, but has anybody ever got really angry because they tried one of your tips and it blew up?
No, thankfully not. I've never gotten any negative feedback or anything about something where a tip has gone wrong. No, that definitely keeps me awake at night a little bit, because when you put information out there like that, somebody can say, hey, I read this in a book, and which is why I have the sort of global disclaimer. In any of these things, you have to use common sense, and you should, you know, you need to know, have some sense of what you're doing and you know, safety precautions and stuff, but I think most people are smart enough to use common sense in these things.
You get a message that says your tip changed my life.
I've definitely gotten messages from people who say, like, you know, this is just absolutely, it's been a game changer for me. They use that term a lot, game changer. And I know exactly what they mean. It's just like, now it's what they do every time they go into the shop or whatever. Or anytime they're gluing something, they use the gluing tip or whatever.
We've almost reached the end of our hour, and I guess my final question is, do you have any tips for us?
Well, hey, one thing I do have in my book is I did a new chapter on maker video production, because there's so many people doing maker videos, and because I watch so many of them, I start to get really critical of, oh my God, this guy's going on twice as long as he needs to, or, oh my God, his fingernails are so filthy. Like, if you're gonna, I get it. If you're doing like machining or mechanics or whatever, you're going to have filthy hands. But if you're doing something that's a clean activity and your fingernails are dirty. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write up some of these observations. And hopefully they'll be helpful to people. So
so you've become the Siskel and Ebert of maker videos. All right.
Here's one that I want to globally share, at least to make my life easier, is people do not put their names on their YouTube channels. Like, more often than not, if you go to the About Me or whatever on a person's YouTube channel, they tell you who they are, but they don't tell you what their name is. And so, again, because I want to create this sense of community, I always want to refer to the person. I don't want to refer to the channel. So that just drives me crazy. Sometimes I'll spend 20 minutes trying to find someone's name. I do web searches. I have to search on the Whois directory to find out who registered their domain. Just like, please put your name on your work.
That's great. I didn't really realize that. That's kind of crazy. It seems like it's
astonishing. I just think that they don't realize it. They're not aware of the fact that they don't say their name on any of their videos. Sometimes I'll go through pages of comments to see if maybe a friend of theirs or someone who knows their work refer to them by their first name so that I can use it.
Well, our names are all over our YouTube, and yours will be on this one, which will be on YouTube.
Right on. So thanks, Gare, for coming and joining us again. And I hope that you'll come back yet another time
The future. No, it's always fun to hang out with you guys.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.